Session number 10776, Reel 3.
Dr. Pat Rawlins, Reel 3.
Right, well, we've just reached Mohe, and Colonel Zhang Yuan Zhang, we called him. Yeah, Zhang Yuan Zhang, which was his title. I think his actual name was Zhang Wenxi, but Zhang Yuan Zhang, we called him. And he was very kindly disposed to us and insisted that we stayed in Mohe, which in fact we did, but I rather imagine it would have been under the sort of threat that if we tried to get on down to Samar, which was still another 3 days further, his soldiers would prevent us. I may be maligning him, I don't know, because, as I said, I didn't understand the negotiations that were going on at the time, which were between Art Bar, with Charlie Liu's interpreter, and Zhang Yuan Zhang. But I'm pretty certain now, looking back, and I think Jane would corroborate this, that in fact, we weren't allowed to go on. He was very keen that there should be a medical service there, and he said, well, you can use our old hospital. There had been a clinic there in the past run by a Chinese doctor who had moved away. There was no actual inpatient facility there at all, but there was this courtyard and a typical Chinese two-story house with the courtyard in the centre, which had been used, and there was a certain amount of medical apparatus and some old drugs there, and we were told we would stay there. And I think that Art Bar must have had... You see, the problem was that any communication with FAU in Kunming took 2 weeks to get. Actually, the postal runners were incredible, really. They used to just go single-footed, as it were, and do it in between 11 and 12 days very often. But it still meant that there was about a fortnight before, a month before you could even get a reply back from Kunming. So it was all... very dodgy, and anyway, we stayed on, and we were very soon. I've suddenly remembered somebody I've left out. I knew there was somebody, and that was Squint Marquis, an incredible Portuguese. He was from Macau, and he was another one who was trained as a lab man. And nurse, and he came down with us. But I'll come to why I'd forgotten about him, because he wasn't with us very long, actually. And so anyway, that was the whole team. And so we settled there into Mohe. We were given these this upstairs sort of gallery around the... It was all open to the fresh air at the side there. A marvellous climate, of course, and we had this upstairs sort of dormitory where we ate and slept, and we all sort of had our beds with mosquito nets round, so we were able to have our little bit of privacy. And we had a Chinese cook, Yang Sao, and two boys, and then another senior boy, Li Hai Shu, who... he couldn't speak any English, but he just knew everybody in around. He was a sort of he knew a bit of medicine and done a bit of training as well. And so we set up this clinic, Art Bar largely responsible for the sort of basic start, until we'd been going about I should think best part of a month before he then left. And we had change of interpreter, and I can't just remember. I think Charlie Liu went back with him, and David Yu came down. He stayed with us the rest of the time. He must have come down on his own, but or else, yes. I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit mixed up here. I can't just remember the details, because a little bit later, after Art Bar had gone back, I don't know what it was, but Squint Marquis had somehow had words with Art Bar, and we had to send Squint back, because he went slightly round the bend. I think actually Charlie Liu went back with him, and then David Yu came down in his place.
This sort of coming and going indicates that Zhang, you know, the warlord, was fairly flexible, about the team generally. But would you say you definitely were held there? Sort of under some sort of threat.
I had no evidence of it.
Did you feel that then?
No.
Did you?
No. Only I think from things that Jane has said later on, she was very afraid to get in touch or to mention anything about it, because by then, during the 60s and 70s, of course, when I was writing by letter and so on, she was very much afraid that the then Mao regime would persecute anybody who had had anything to do with people like Zhang Yuanzhang, you see. I gathered from her fear of discussing, she wouldn't even discuss anything about it, so that's why I just don't know. I couldn't understand at the time, because I didn't know the language. She knew the language and wouldn't say anything, so there was something peculiar about it, although Zhang Yuanzhang was extremely friendly towards us. Of course, I suppose he wanted a hospital there, and we were given everything. I mean, we were feasted and taken to these enormous parties. We were really part of the community there, and it was quite fantastic, really. And
it sounds as if he was, quite considerate of.
Oh, he was good. Yes, this was the paradoxical thing about it, was that everybody respected him there. He held sway, and he was a good man in his own way. I suppose, he was what you would call a beneficent. I don't know whether I don't like the word warlord really, because he wasn't really warlike, but he had his own soldiers, militia, and that was their way of keeping peace. There was a magistrate there, but of course, as so often was the case, the officials were opium smokers and had lost their influence, really.
That had been unusual in China then, explicit.
Not in that part of China. Opium smoking was the normal way. The normal greeting when you went to anybody's house, would you like a cup of tea or a pipe of opium? I invariably chose the cup of tea and became addicted to Chinese tea, but not to opium, I'm glad to say. But, so that a person like Zhang Yuanzhang was, that was the way of life in those days, and a good man, as he was, had a good influence, although he was powerful, but there again, I should suspect that his militia were largely used in protecting the opium trade through. You see, they could control everything. The opium was coming up from Burma, I wouldn't put it past possibility that they had to pay a toll to bring it through, you see, to Jiang's soldiers, and of course went through to him. And this was the sort of way it went, but we saw nothing of that, really. We were just living like the ordinary citizens of the village, and except that we were, when there was a party or anything, they had a marvellous way of putting on a feast. And one of the occasions was when, for some reason or other, it may have been for some special occasion, they dammed the river and just took out all the fish in the pool below. And one huge fish, about, I think, weighed about 20 or 30 pounds, they baked and had it as the sort of dish of the day for this great feast. And we used to eat elephant's trunk and stags, deer's tendons and things like that, and every sort of grub, or they were all called chung, anything that sort of creeps or crawls is a chung. And or sort of crayfish and things, snails, water snails, all sorts of things out of the river were all cooked. And then we had the chung out of a bee's nest, wild bees. They just took all the grubs out, chung again, and fried them up, made them into delicious things. They were all lovely things to eat.
Well, what was the condition of the people there? Because I suppose that's what you were there for.
Yeah, well, you see, they had awful diseases, but not much in the way of nutritional troubles, because in actual fact, the rice that they ate was mostly unmilled brown rice, and they had their pigs and their chickens, and so there was always a bit of pork meat or chicken meat with the rice. Vegetables, of course, they grew in profusion. And fruit, I mean, there were mangoes, peaches, pears, all gorgeous fruit. So really, you had even the poor people had a bit of everything in their diet. So we didn't see much in the way of nutritional deficiency, but every sort of other tropical disease was rife. Malaria, relapsing fever, which was louse-borne, the louse-borne type of relapsing fever, dysentery, amoebic and bacillary dysentery. Those, I suppose, were the chief things. And, of course, all sorts of horrible skin conditions and leg ulcers and things like that. We had with us the latest thing of the day, which was sulfathiazole, M&B 760, I think it was. 693 was the sulfapyridine that was very toxic. 760 was a little less toxic. But it was quite magic, actually, what you could do with people whose presumably their own antibody levels were pretty high, having fought bacterial or amoebic or some kind of protozoal disease for a long time on their own. Those who'd survived, you only had to give them a few tablets of sulfathiazole for, say, a big ulcer of the leg or something, and the whole thing would clear up like magic, just amazing. And the other thing we had because we had the blood films were necessary to detect malaria, at what stage malaria, but of course we only had quinine and mepocrine. We were able to get, actually, what we found was most effective, and the people all demanded it, was injections of their own. Quinine, it was Chinese-made quinine injections, which, of course, we'd been taught at the School of Tropical Medicine that you should never inject quinine because it will form a great big ulcerated area. But this stuff, Febnon it was called, gave in to demand and injected this deep into the muscles of the thigh, and we never had any trouble with it. It was a bit painful, but it used to clear up their attacks of malaria marvellously. And so we went very much over to that and used the mepocrine for prophylaxis. And then the other thing, of course, that was apparent on the blood films was the relapsing fever. Of course, nowadays you use penicillin for that. It was a spirochetal thing, you see. We had what they called Duisir 914, which was the Bayer's, the German preparation, arsenical, which was used for syphilis, of course, which was the other rife. Although we didn't see it there, but that was a spirochetal disease. And the arsenical things were used for spirochetal diseases. we hadn't got any distilled water, so we used to get boiled rainwater and dissolve the 914 up in that and inject this intravenously. And one shot of that would cure the relapsing fever. Very differently, I gather, from the poor chaps in North Africa who had the other form of relapsing fever, which was, I think it was a tick-borne one, that, but which didn't respond to arsenicals, and they used to go on and, you know, die of it. But if they could, they, without any treatment, the Chinese louse-borne one, would they'd die just the same. But we could stop it with the arsenical injection. So this was all a sort of medical thing. We had quite a lot of surgery to do as well. I should go back a little bit and say this. We couldn't do any surgery because we hadn't anywhere to do it. But now one of the things that Zhang promised was that if we stayed, he'd build us a hospital, which he did. And it was really marvellous because we'd been there 6 months or so when they started building right opposite, on the other side of the road from our clinic. And we actually watched. It was wonderful to see them bringing the great timber logs down and edging them into squares and then erecting them up and then putting on this marvellous Chinese roof, you know, we actually watched it all happening. And mind you, now I still haven't mentioned Barbara, have I? While we were doing this, we had this Barbara Yang, who left her family and joined us and became one of our team. So she picked up nursing and helping at operations and all sorts of things. She was a wonderful help to us.
Was she a local girl?
Yes, just a local girl. She'd only about 17 and just left school. And I don't quite know how it was that she came to join us, but that was right in the early days when Bernard Barr was still there, and she came and joined us then, and she stayed with us right through to the end. And of course, when we opened the hospital, she was able to help us with operations and all sorts of things. And we started doing small operations. We did a lot of, actually, there was a lot of trachoma. And we did this, the trachoma people, sort of their eyelids turned inwards, and we did a little plastic operation to make them turn outwards again, so as to prevent the lashes growing and damaging the surface of the eye. I did sort of some hernia ops and appendix and things like that, but I was never much of a surgeon, actually, so
Did you see some very sort of dramatic cases?
Oh, gosh, we saw things we really couldn't do anything much about. Women in... childbirth was a thing that was so terribly secret, and we had these... They had the old sort of Sarah Gamp kind of ladies, you know, and occasionally we'd get called in when things had gone sort of, well, quite impossible, kind of. Once or twice I had to deliver a stillborn baby, that, you know, and I'm afraid once or twice mothers died in labour that there was no way we could prevent, you know, it had happened. But mostly we didn't see anything much of the very high birth rate, of course, but it all happened behind the scenes in the old traditional way. I suppose the old grandmas and people ordered it, and the midwives, if you can call them such. Anyway, it all happened very naturally.
Did you make home visits, though?
Oh, yes, 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 we did. It was very like sort of very basic GP work here, and Lee Heischer was the chap that used to take the calls while we did the clinic in the morning. We had sometimes up to 90 patients in a morning, and then people would say... will the doctor come and see so-and-so, and he'd make a list of them, and then he'd take me round with Jane and David Yee, who acted as interpreter. And, of course, after about 6 months of this, I more or less dispensed with David and could speak enough of it to manage on my own. Although he was always very useful as a medical helper, I relied less and less on him for language. And, we did these rounds in the afternoon. There's a photo, one of those there, actually, too. And occasionally, this was particularly when someone in the distant mountains needed an urgent visit, you'd have a couple of horses come down, one with a rider and the other with a riderless, and come on, you've got to go up to see so-and-so up in the mountains. And I had several trips out like that. And two of them, very dramatic, actually. One of them was to an old lady who'd had a dislocated jaw for a couple of weeks. And just by good fortune, actually, I'd learnt when I was casualty officer at Ealing, I'd found the knack of getting these jaws back, but always with the help of a little anaesthetic, or, when they were quite recent, but this one had been out for a couple of weeks, and the old dear, after a very difficult struggle, I managed to get it back, and the dear old thing, I never forget, she it was just like... when St. Paul was shipwrecked on Malta, a snake came out of this fire and he picked it up, and somebody sort of fell down and worshipped him, and he said, come on, I'm not God. And I had to do just the same. This dear old thing, she sort of fell down on the floor like this, and I had to sort of pick her up and say, you know. And the other time, this fairly rich old man sent for me with a horse like this, and I went out, and there was absolute pandemonium, because he'd sent to me because he got a very bad tummy ache, and I think he got colic or diarrhea or something. But in the general panic going on, the old lady who used to look after him, I think she was probably his number three wife or something like that, and she had bound legs, and had fallen over the dog and broken her leg, and they'd sent for the Chinese iguan to see to her, and he was setting the leg in a red rice, sticky rice plaster, and So I had to see to the old man and gave him something, some morphine mixture or something for his tummy. And so then I quizzed this iguan, and he said, he was very good, really. He got it into good position, and he said this rice would set hard, just like a plaster, and it would be about 6 weeks before her leg was better, and then perhaps another few weeks or something before she could walk again. And it all fitted in very much with orthopaedic practice. And so, yes, I had some rather sort of interesting...
Did people have to pay for this? I was wondering about the very poor people.
No, we did this all absolutely free, yes. I think that what payment there was done by... The hospital, the new hospital, was paid for by Jiang Yunjiang putting a tax on meat in the market. So that was a sort of power he had, and people paid up and paid for the hospital like that.
And it really was for the benefit of everyone.
Oh yes, yes. Oh yes, yes. So we insisted that that all the treatment was free. This is why we were so popular. they couldn't believe it, really.
How far was it your influence on him? This idea of, you know, the medicine for everyone. Did you have a? Would you say the FAU, your little team, were important?
Oh, I should think it was unheard of. I mean, to have free sort of health service like that. Mind you, the public health authority was quite efficient there, really, and children were vaccinated. They had their own Chinese vaccine, smallpox vaccine, which was very efficient, and all that was done free. I don't think they got diphtheria immunization or anything like that, but it was mainly the anti-smallpox campaign. That was certainly free. And there were sort of basic child clinics and things like that that were free as well.
Something else, you know, mentioning this chap who put the rice on to set the leg. Did you learn anything about sort of herbal medicine? I wondered if this had an influence on your own sort of medical practices.
Not really, because I never really got to understand it anyway. I think in those days there wasn't anything like the belief in Chinese herbal traditional medicine that there is now. I mean, now there's a lot of inquiry into it by Western and Chinese medical people, but in those days we rightly or wrongly regarded it as a lot of nonsense, you know, and we could so obviously prove that our Western things were far superior because they worked. I mean, a few pills of sulfathiazole and the magic happened, and you know, the news soon got round, and people came flocking. They came from all over the place. I mean, some of them were brought on stretchers over the mountain, sort of 4 or 5 days, and this kind of thing. And very often, perhaps moribund by the time they got to us, you know, this kind of thing. One chap I remember brought like that with an enormous hernia right down here. And, you know, we tried to do, I forget. Now, whether I actually got it, I think I told him I couldn't do it. I literally couldn't do it. It was beyond my capacity.